The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
We have entered Teshuvah season. Pretty soon you'll be praying by a pond, eating in a hut, and swinging a chicken around your head. But this week, all across the world, we started at the beginning of Teshuvah season with the sound of the shofar as we entered the month of Elul. The shofar is the primary mitzvah associated with the upcoming holiday of Rosh Hashanah, and we thought it would be pertinent to go through some of the practical workings of the shofar with this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Michael Cohen. I'm the Baal Tokea of a shul in Kew Gardens Hills, Congregation Eitz Chaim. I've been the Baal Tokea there for about 26 years.
Michael will share his wealth of shofar-related knowledge with us, and may even show us some skills he has with the shofar that you may not have known even existed. All right, Michael, thank you so much for joining me this week. This is a pleasure. This is actually the second time after COVID has hit us that I've been able to record a podcast live with a person in the same room. So I'm very glad that we're able to do this. And I'm glad that you're able to be my second person doing this. Can I get a little background on you? Obviously, you've been about the care for a while, but if you can give us a little bit more of a background on how you got to that point and what you're up to now.
So in terms of how I became a Baal Tokea, when I was younger, I never thought I would ever be a Baal Tokea. But as it happens, I am also a trumpet player. And I used to play, for instance, at Jewish simchas as well as classical concerts. And I never planned on being a Baal Tokea, but about 26 years ago, the same year that the previous rabbi of Eitz Chaim was leaving the shul, also their Baal Tokea was leaving. And so the outgoing rabbi asked me if I would become the Baal Tokea, and I said yes. So that's my history as far as being a Baal Tokea. And in general, I had worked for about 36 years for a large computer software company. And more recently, I learn at Kollel Agra D'Pirka here in Kew Gardens Hills, and also learning in various other venues. And I am a part-time professor at Lander College for Men.
Yeah, very nice. So I want to get a little bit into the trumpet playing versus shofar playing. So easy question: how does one help or hinder the other?
It mostly helps. There's absolutely a lot of crossover between the two. Obviously, you know, both are essentially played the same way with buzzing your lips and using air. So there's a lot of crossover, and it really helps to be a trumpet player. But of course, that said, so many Baalik Tekea are so wonderful and were never trumpet players. So it's obviously not something that one needs to have done. I think in my own case, I would say two things. First of all, when Rabbi Przanski asked me to be the Baal Tokea, perhaps I'm sort of a shy person, and maybe the fact that I'm a trumpet player already maybe helped me feel like, oh sure, I could do this because I'm halfway there already, rather than me being reticent about the idea of taking on the responsibility. It encouraged me. The other aspect for my own personal self as far as the trumpet playing is that it's always good to, when you're doing a mitzvah, to be able to make use of your natural abilities. And so the fact that I'm able to do a mitzvah where I'm also being, you know, yotzei other people, and I'm making use of the abilities that I gained as a trumpet player, of course, I appreciate that.
Do you think that somebody going the other way, somebody who knows how to blow a shofar, would be able to pick up the trumpet easier than somebody who's picking it up blind?
To some extent, yes, because again, the basic principles are the same. You know, the average person who picks up a trumpet, maybe they think you're just going to blow into it or something, whereas a Baal Tokea will know about the chachma of how to produce a sound that way. There is a slight problem, perhaps, because a shofar preferably is blown from the right side of the mouth. Okay, there's a certain Kabbalistic sort of an idea there, basically, where there's a pasuk that pictures the satan as being on the right-hand side of us, and we blow on the right-hand side to counter the satan. So preferably, although it's not ma'akev, although it's not required, but preferably one blows the shofar out of the right side of the lip, whereas trumpet is usually blown from the middle. So, you know, there could be a little bit of an adjustment there.
Have you ever tried blowing the trumpet out of the right side of the mouth?
I've only tried it when I try to play two trumpets at a time, which is something that, you know, some people like to do. So I've tried that, and that's the only time I've done that.
All right.
Doesn't come out too well for me. but I'm sure, like everything else with practice, I could make it work.
I would love to hear that. I want to break up this conversation into three different tiers. I want to talk about the halachic aspect of tikkun shofar. I want to talk about the technical, the actual blowing, and then some practical things for people to keep in mind. So I want to start with the halachos, first of all. So let's talk about the halachos that are specifically geared to a baal tokea, things that the layperson who's not blowing a shofar might not understand fully or even have to understand because they're not really blowing the shofar. So let's start, first of all, the getting ready for the actual tekiahs, both from in your mind and from a practical standpoint.
So knowing the halachos, of course, are very important, and it's really analogous, let's say, to a musician who has to know the piece of music they're going to play, to know the score, so to speak. When you're blowing shofar, you're basically playing to a certain score. That score originates with just a few words in the Torah, just three references to the word trua, and one word vahavarta, and then Chazal have expounded on the meaning of those words and have been able to codify into a full score, if you will, a full piece of music, what we're supposed to be doing. And of course, that is reflected, for example, in the Shulchan Aruch or the Mishnah Berurah. So a Baal Tekea, of course, has to know that. And indeed, although I'm sure at one time or the other I had at least casually learned the halachos, when I was asked to become a Baal Tekea, I did sit down and go through the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah, and also the original sugyos in Masechtas Rosh Hashanah as well. I went through those in depth, and there were definitely things that one learns that you realize that as the audience, as the listener, people might not be aware of that, but as a Baal Tekea, you must be aware of these things. I would say in many cases, the listener, so to speak, meaning the people in shul who are being yotzei the mitzvah from you, they would perhaps, certain things that they might hear, let's say a certain type of mistake, and they might think, oh, well, that was a bad mistake. Doesn't he have to do it over again? And yet really the Baal Tekea doesn't have to do that over again. Yet there are other things that they might not be aware of that are actually ma'akev, that would actually prevent you from being yotzei the mitzvah. So, for example, one example of that would be people are probably not aware of the fact when they hear a tekiah, and maybe that people are sometimes saying, oh, that was a long tekiah, wow, that was really great, or whatever. People may not be aware that the length of the tekiah is important, but it's only important with regards to or in comparison to whatever kolos are contained within the starting and then last tekiah of that set. So someone might hear some tekiahs are longer and some tekiahs are shorter and might wonder why that is. When you know the halacha, you know that, let's say, if the two tekiahs are surrounding only a shvarim, let's say, then those tekiahs can be shorter. But if they're surrounding a shvarim trua, then those tekiahs can be longer. It's what I like to call the hamburger bun rule. Like if you go into a restaurant and you order a hamburger on a bun, you really wouldn't be that happy, I think, if the hamburger was sticking out of the bun. It makes it harder to hold, your hands get greasy. So you expect the bun to be at least as wide as the hamburger.
Right.
Well, the tekiah needs to be at least as long as whatever is in between the two tekiahs.
Does it work the other way? If I wanted to order if I ordered a tiny hamburger but had a huge bun, would that be a problem also that way?
So halakhically, the tekiah can be as long as you want. There's no limit.
Okay. So I was going to get into that in a little bit when we talk about the technical stuff, but I'm glad you brought it up now. While we're on that topic, the tekiah gedola, the timing of the tekiah gedola, is that, first of all, a source of pride for Baalei Tekea? Do you guys, I know a lot of people in the kehillah, like we look at the clock, like, all right, how long is it going to be this time? But do you guys like time that? You want to have like somebody in the audience tell you how long you did so you can brag to your friends later?
I personally don't look at it like that. I'm not looking to break any records. So the purpose of the tekiahs gedolos is really as a siman to the kahal, to know that we're done with a particular set or that we're done completely. So it's really, you know, obviously it's, some people may be proud of how long they can do it, but it has a, you know, just a practical implication.
So let me get back to the halachas that we were talking about before. So we talked about your mindset before. What about your mindset during? What are you actually, like, we're trying to concentrate on the kolos. Then we'll get to what the kehillah is supposed to be concentrating on in a few minutes. But what are you, as the Baal Tokeah, what are you thinking about while you're blowing?
So, of course, everyone knows that there are so many different kavanos that one can have in mind. And, you know, if you look in a sefer like the Shla, there are kavanos that some of which we can't even understand. And there are many svarim written in that area. And, of course, we know that they've been condensed very nicely by the 10 kavanos that Rav Sadia Gaon lists for us to have in mind. But what I will tell you, for example, when I was first asked to be the Baal Tokeah, I had a conversation with a Rosh Yeshiva. He happens to be my uncle, but I had a conversation with him. And he asked me, so, in fact, his question was very similar to what you're asking me now. And he said to me, so what will your main kavana be when you're blowing? So I said that I'm doing a mitzvah sasei mida araisa, and that I'm having in mind to be yotza others in that mitzvah. So that is the essential kavana. By the way, he was impressed with that answer. because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. It's a mitzvah saseh. Kavanas are very important. They're wonderful. But let's keep in mind that the mitzvah, as stated in the Torah, doesn't give any reason for the mitzvah. And the Rambam and others point this out, that it's a gezeira shava. It's just how it is. It's stated in the Torah with no reason. And while it's always very good for us to be able to think of various kavanos, and I'll get to what I think about, but the main thing that I think about is merely the fact that this is a mitzvah sasei midaraisa, and I'm being yotze that mitzvah, and also being motzi other people with it. So that's really the key kavana, and that is potentially ma'akev. I mean, it is important for the Baal Tokeah to know that he's doing a mitzvah, because we know that the din is, let's say if someone else would hear what's known as someone who's being misasek, meaning someone who's just fooling around on a shofar, happens to blow a beautiful tekiah, shvarim, chua tekiah, beautiful kolos, but he's just, you know, fooling around or learning or whatever, other people would not be yotzei from him. So clearly that's important. Beyond that, I would say what I have in mind is generally at least a subset of the 10 kavanos that Rav Sadia lists.
Right, and a subset of those things, is there any one in particular or a few in particular that you like to keep in mind? I mean, it's hard to keep 11 things in mind at
right.
once.
So the idea that a tekiah is an image, a sound image of shalva, of peace, of tranquility, following the cry out of the shvarim and or the trua. So the idea that we should always be moving from situation of needing to cry out into a situation of shalva.
I happen to know that you daven in a shul that blows during the quiet Shemone Esrei, the individual Shemone Esrei. Do you prefer that, or without you know talking out against your shul or praising whatever you want to do? But do you prefer the shofar being blown during the silent Shemone Esrei or not?
So I personally actually daven Nusach Sfard. That is my upbringing, and that is the common minhag amongst Nusach Sfard, and that's how I grew up. So I'm very good with it.
It's interesting because I didn't start davening in the same shul as you until I was, you know, maybe 12, 13 years old, and I grew up in a shul that didn't have that. And the first time that I moved over to a shul that did do that, even though it's Nusach Ashkenaz, it was startling. First of all, I didn't really know what that meant. Like, they announced it before davening, but in my mind, it didn't click. And then when they started blowing, like, oh, that's what that means. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. That's different. I didn't like it initially. It was different. But now I prefer it. As someone who davens for the Almighty Am Norum, I definitely prefer that. It breaks it up a little bit more. It gives me a little bit more chance to think. And it also makes the Kaddish at the end, I guess, more bearable. Probably for sure for a Baal Tokeah. You don't have to get 40 done in one shot.
Right. I suppose it is easier for the Baal Tokeah. Really, although you've listed some reasons regarding convenience, the reason it's a good thing to do The reason that I like it is because the sugyos in Maseches Rosh Hashanah point out the tight cohesion between the three brachos of Malchus, Sichronos, and Shofros, that they really are tied, you know, together with the kolos themselves.
So why? What's the answer to why do shuls not do that?
That's a good question. I don't really know why the other minhag exists so widely. I'm not really sure. It could be, for example, that for matters of you know, just making it easier for the kahal, because it is a little jarring for some people, and it also it does cut off. It may make some people have to cut off their tefillos in the middle. Obviously, the mitzvah of shofar is such that when the Baal Tekeah is blowing, then the people have to stop davening. Even if they were in the middle, they have to stop in order to be yotze the kolos. They cannot be yotze the kolos while they're actually davening. So that may be disconcerting for some people to have to, someone who's davening very slow with kavana and then has to stop in the middle. So, you know, it could be just for that reason that maybe some congregations, you know.
It's a similar thing to what we talked about earlier with Laman Atzeach. If I'm, first of all, if you said somebody's davening slower, somebody's davening faster, they have to sit there and wait for a while.
Right, right. That can also be disconcerting.
Right.
Right. In other words, it's certainly a big change to the normal rhythm of things that people are used to. You know, it's almost like a change in decorum, if you want to call it that. It could be jarring to some people, but it really seems to be a better way of tying together the brachos with the kolos.
Right. But for the people who are davening a little slower, they're not necessarily tying the kolos with the brachos because they're stopping at different points.
That's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. But for those who are diving around the same pace as most of the kehillah, I guess that works. I want to move over. Let's move over into more of the kehillah since we're there already. We spoke about what the Baal Tekeah has in mind. Does the kehillah have to have a similar... Obviously, we're going to say, to be yotze, the mitzvah of Tekeah Shofar. But what about the other things? Should there be other things that the kehillah has in mind?
So I would say that the kahal has, obviously, they have the potential... And this is also, by the way, especially true of the Makri. Okay, the Makri is really designated, aside from being someone who just mechanically calls out the next kol, the Makri is also really supposed to have sort of as a shliach tzibur, is supposed to really have in mind the kavanos on behalf of the kahal. So the Makri, and certainly the kahal as well, they have the potential, they have the opportunity in some ways to have more kavanos in mind than the Baal Tekeah. Because let's face it, the Baal Tekeah is maybe nervous, maybe focusing on technical issues, might get disturbed when there's maybe some noise or something. There's all sorts of things that can intrude on the Baal Tekeah's ability to have sophisticated kavanos in mind. So the Makri and the Kahal, they have the potential to have more kavanos in mind than the Baal Tekeah. And, you know, certainly I hope that people are able to take that opportunity. But, you know, certainly, again, the short list, so to speak, of Rav Sadia Gaon is a wonderful list for people to try to have in mind. And in terms of the different kolos, like I mentioned before, when someone hears a shvarim or a trua, they should be thinking, you know, this is the sound that is a crying sound, and they should be thinking, you know, what are we crying about, and then what kind of shalva do we really want?
Right.
When they hear the tkiah, a nice smooth pashut sound, they should be thinking of the shalva that they want, and hopefully that's a ruchniyistika shalva would be, you know, the best kind of shalva to be davening for.
And for those of you, I think that on the original, like, Hebrew English art scroll, Machzorim, I think Rav Sadia's 10 thoughts are in there.
They're right there.
So
yeah,
you don't have to look that far. Most people have that. If not, probably your local Orthodox synagogue will have one. I did mention Laman Atzeach. So Laman Atzeach is the parak of Tilm that we say right before Shofar. Now, there's a minhag to say that 7 times. So let's talk about that. First of all, why 7? And second of all, what happens if you're still going and the chazan's ready to start the kia?
So the Lam Latzeach, of course, has some very important ideas contained in it. The pasuk, it has the pasuk Allah Elokim Bisruah Hashem Bakol Shofar, which is of course it's mentioning shofar, but it's also mentioning it starts off using the shame Elokim, which is the shame of Din, the strict justice name of God. So Allah Elokim Bisruah Hashem Bakol Shofar. It starts with the name of Din Elokim, and then it goes up with shofar into the name of Rachamim. So that's an example of why that particular Tehillim is so important and relevant to the mitzvah. The repetition seven times, I think it has to do with ending up with having 49 psukim, I think, in total being said. I don't remember exactly why we want that number. But of course, even though the kavanas in that particular mizmor are very important, Of course, if someone is davening it very slow and now the Baal Takeah gets up to, actually blowing, one should not be involved in saying that Tehillim at that time.
Hmm. Every year we hear if somebody needs shofar blown in their house, like people come over. Unfortunately, some people can't make it to shul. They miss shofar for whatever reason. If somebody needs it, what is the actual minimum number of kolos that somebody needs to hear, versus what we generally do 100 kolos, but then there's 30, there's 7, 1. What is the actual number?
Right. So a person in the house certainly does not have to hear 100. The mea kolos that we do was masakein for the kahal. It is not related directly to the mitzvah. We're doing 100 kolos to basically be yotze different sorts of ideas such as the Aim Sisra, who cried for her lost villain son 100 times. So there are ideas supporting the 100 kolos, but the Ikar Mitzvah is definitely not 100, and no one has to ever think that they should have to hear 100 kolos if they are not in the, you know, if it's not part of a tzibur and their tefillah. So I'll answer that the minimum is 30, and that's 30 simply because in order to be yotze all the deos in terms of what a trua is, the combination that comes out would be 30. In other words, min haTorah, what we actually have is a requirement for 3 truos, mm-hmm. with each trua to be surrounded by a tekiah. So if a trua was 1 kol, let's say like what we call a trua nowadays, so that would mean a total of 9 kolos. But we know that there is a difference of opinion or different ways of being yotze what a trua is. So we know that we have really 3 different ways. We have what we call a shvarim, we have what we call a trua, and then we have the combined shvarim trua. So if you add all those combinations together, it comes out to 30. So generally speaking, the minimum requirement is 30. So someone who's hearing blowing in their house would be yotze with 30. Since you're asking about the minimum requirement, I guess I would have to note that in the case of an extreme problem, let's say like a chayal, a soldier who's, you know, preoccupied in battle all day, it is potentially possible to be yotze the mitzvah with 9 kolos, to hear basically, you know, tarat, tarat, tarat would in, you know, a bidyeved, one could assume that someone like a soldier, or I don't know if such a thing could happen, but I mean, let's say if a doctor was mamish busy all day saving lives and only had, you know, 20 seconds to take out for blowing shofar, and if he would do tarat, 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 presumably he would be yotze the mitzvah, certainly bidyeved. One other point regarding that, understanding why one might be yotze. I mean, you might ask, well, why do we make such a big deal of doing all the different ways, tarat, tashat, and everything, if you could be yotze that way? So I just want to point out that, so the Gemara in Masechta Rosh Hashanah, so it says, Askin Ravavo be Kesaria. Ravavo established in Kesaria, he made the takana to do what we do nowadays, which is to blow all 3 ways. And the Poshet reading of that sugya is that there was a machlokes, and the way to resolve the machlokes was some sort of a hachra, some sort of a compromise that did all of them. But it should be noted that Rav Haigon, I think it's brought down in the Rush, Rav Haigon says, it's not that there was a machlokes, as in people saying, oh, the other way is wrong. Instead, Rav Haigon says, look, different communities develop different ways, and some of them did it one way, and some of them did it another way. And according to Rav Haigon, Rav Avohu's takana was just to make it, let's have all of Klal Yisrael blowing the same way. So therefore, it's certainly a wonderful thing to get the 30 kolos, but the reason I'm saying is that you might be yotze with 9 is because the takana notwithstanding, it would seem, at least according to Rav Haigon, that any of those ways was valid by themselves.
So we have this minhag, if not halacha, that we're not allowed to talk from the time you make the bracha until after you hear the kolos. When does that time end? Most shuls, they say, from you can't talk from now until the end of Kaddish, at the end of Shemoneh Esrei, but how much of that is because you don't want to break up the kolos, and how much of that is because you're not supposed to talk during, you know, Shemoneh Esrei, Chazon Shatz, and Kaddish?
Right. So first of all, a Baal Tokea definitely should not talk at all until the end of Kaddish. I mean, you know, until the last kolos. The Kahal also preferably should not talk the whole time, because let's keep in mind a Birchas HaMitzvah was made, and even though, let's say, the last kolos may not be ma'akev regarding the mitzvah, they may not be inherently required for the mitzvah, but we are trying to be yotza all the deos, and we are trying to achieve all the different kavanos. So if you want that birchas ha-mitzvah to, you know, apply, so to speak, to all the other kolos, then you should not have a hesek hadas or speak in between. But certainly for the first 30 kolos, that is a clear requirement that people should not talk at that time under no circumstance. After that, you know, everyone in accordance with their ability should try to be quiet.
It's interesting because while we're not talking, let's say, just whatever we're talking about, but there's other things that we are talking about. Davening Shemoneh Esrei, there's other things that are coming out of our mouth. You, I know, are a Kohen, and you're going to be duchening in the middle of that. These are other brachos that you're saying in between the bracha and the actual completion.
Right. That's right. Kolos. But it is all tefillah. It's all tefillah. And indeed, by the way, according to many opinions, tkiah shofar is tefillah. Okay? It's an inyan of tefillah. So it's all combined as part of the tefillah. So even though you're right that technically you are saying other words, but it's all part of the corpus of tefillah, and the kolos are part of the tefillah in this case. So the you know, davening is not a hesek hadas in this case, whereas you know, talking about something totally unrelated would be a hesek hadas.
And wrapping up our discussion on the tefillah part, kolos at the end, because we started in the beginning, going to the end, kolos at the end of Shemoneh Esrei, at the Kaddish after Shemoneh Esrei, so it's a machlokas as to where in Kaddish those kolos are supposed to go, whether they're supposed to go before Tiskabel or right before Otsa Shalom. What is that machlokas, and where? Why do we hold what we hold?
So there is a there are a number of different opinions there. In fact, I have a sefer here called Kol Shofar, which it's a very interesting sefer. It's written by Rav Amram Buskila, and he goes through the standard halachos, but he also goes through all the minhagim that exist all throughout the world and all the different countries, what they do. And there's a very wide variation about what people do in terms of when to do, for instance, the Tekiah Gedola at the end. So, for example, I think that most kehilos around here that I've seen do what we do in Eitz Chaim, for example, which is to blow that last set of kolos before Tiskabel, and that includes the Tekiah Gedola. But for example, there's another minhag to do, let's say, perhaps those kolos, but not with a Tekiah Gedola, and then to do separate by itself a Tekiah Gedola after Kaddish. So there's just a very, very wide variation of minhagim. I don't know the reasons for each different minhag.
Okay. There's something that I was always interested in as to where those differences are. Let's move on to the technical, actual blowing of the shofar. We already mentioned the length of the tekiah. We got a little bit into that. Let's really start with the actual shofar itself. Does the size of the shofar matter? Does the shape of the shofar matter? I know that we don't use necessarily that triple loop one for
Rosh Hashanah. I have one of those up there, see?
Yeah.
So the shape matters. In fact, the shape is mentioned by the Mechaber. We look to use a shofar that is kafuf, that is essentially curved or pointed up. And that's, again, just a siman, just a sign, like so many things that we do on Rosh Hashanah. It's a siman that we're turning ourselves upwards towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it doesn't have to be like that, but that's what we look for, a shofar that is curved, pointed up. Size, halakhically, well, there's a minimum shear, basically a tefach, which is to say that it should be, the shofar should be able to, if you hold it by your hand, you should be able to see both ends protruding, at least a drop, from either side of your hand. But that would be a pretty small shofar, and a shofar like that would have a very high pitch. The larger the shofar, the deeper the pitch will be. Different people will find it easier to blow different shofros. Every shofar has what in English you might call a sweet spot, meaning the note that makes that shofar resonate best. So that varies on every shofar. It's different. Unlike, for example, on a trumpet, the trumpet has predefined slots, so to speak, where the trumpet vibrates or resonates properly. With a shofar, it really depends on the size of the shofar and also how the mouthpiece was cut out. So, for example, I have two shofros here right now.
And you bring two shofros with you?
Right, I always have two shofros with me. This is the shofar that I don't normally use, and it's on the small side. And, well, it's about 9 inches long, I guess. And you'll notice that it has a high-pitched sound. So it's a kind of a high-pitched sound, whereas the one that I normally use, let's see how much longer it is. So it's definitely bigger, by maybe 4 or 5 inches, and
right. It's
also wider. So it's a much deeper and fuller sound. Yet, some people might find it easier to blow the smaller shofar. I personally happen to like my larger one. It actually behaves more like a trumpet, perhaps. So I prefer that one. Hmm. So the size, other than, of course, satisfying the minimum size of a tefach, the size will matter just in terms of the person's own nature and what they find more comfortable.
And obviously the triple loop one, why don't we use that on Rosh Hashanah?
So we prefer to use, by the way,
I'm calling it the triple loop one. What's it called? I feel like it's a different name for it.
What
do you, if you're referring to it, what are you calling it? You're saying, hey, pass me that.
I would actually call it a Yemenite shofar, because the Yemenite people have the minhag to use that shofar.
Okay.
So our minhag is to use a shofar from an isle, from a ram, with the obvious connection to Akedas Yitzchak.
Right. Oh, okay. So I was under the impression that we only use the ram, but I guess there are other things out there. Maybe that's one of the
right.
reasons why we
do. So basically, there are other types of shofaros that are obviously kosher. Obviously, that shofar from the kudu is kosher. What you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to use a shofar of a cow, a bull, that's usher.
Now, aside from the Baal Tokeya and the Chazan, there's another person involved with this. It's the Makri. So if you could talk a little bit about the role of the Makri and the importance of having a rapport with the Makri.
As I briefly mentioned earlier, the Makri has the one advantage, in a way, over the Baal Tokeya, that he's more well-positioned to be, he's standing there as a representative of the Kahal, and he has more of an opportunity, perhaps, to have more of the Kavanas in his mind than perhaps the Baal Takea may be able to. But from a practical point of view, obviously the Makri is making sure that the Baal Takea is blowing the right kol and properly. Generally speaking, the Makri should be a Mora Halacha. He should be a Posek who can determine whether the kolos were right. And more importantly, to know which type of mistakes require what type of reparation. So if a Makri knows his halacha well, then let's say the Baal Tokeya blows, for example, the most problematic mistakes are mistakes that would cause a hefsek during a shvarim or trua, such as a slightly elongated note.
Can you give us an example of that?
So let's say... Oh, you want me to do something that's wrong on the shofar? I've never done that before.
I don't want to mess you up for this year's Rosh Hashanah, but
okay,
like, I want to hear what a wrong one sounds like.
Yeah, I always, you know, my music teachers always used to tell me things like, you know, practice slow, because otherwise you're practicing mistakes.
Right.
So I don't want to practice mistakes, but...
Okay. It's not a practice mistake. It's an example
of
one.
Yeah, so let's say we were doing a Shvarim Trua.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I was to do something like this by mistake. Let's say my mind... wandered, chas v'shalom, and I thought, oh, I'm just doing a shvarim, or maybe I'm supposed to do a tekiah now, and maybe if I got confused, then what if I would do something like this? what I really just did was, first I did three sounds that would be shvarim, but then I did a longer sound that could have sounded like maybe the fourth tone of a shvarim, and a shvarim is allowed to have a fourth shever. It doesn't, having a fourth shever wouldn't passel a shvarim by itself, but I did end up with kind of a long kol over there, and a long shever could be interpreted as a tekiah. If it's interpreted as a tekiah, and indeed lefi shitas Rashi, I think it is, that kol would have been a tekiah, and now I've interrupted my shvarim and my trua, so I have neither. Right, so that's probably the most complicated case that a makri has to know about, and he would then have to know also, is he now going to call shvarim trua again, or were we mafsid the first tekiah? Did we lose the first tekiah? So that's the important role that the makri plays, to be a mora halacha, to handle especially the mistakes.
Now you mentioned blowing four shvarims is not a problem. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the problems blowing too many shvarims, too many truas, not enough truas?
Right. So my recollection of the Mechaber is that his lashon is that if you blew four or five on shvarim, it's okay. So was he meaning, you know, just up to four or five, or did he mean in general? I'm not really sure. It's hard for me to remember that. Obviously, it would not be a common thing for one to blow. I can understand a mistake and blowing four, but it wouldn't be too common to end up blowing more than four. So I don't remember what would happen if you mamish blew more than even five. But I think his lashon was four or five is okay. For a trua, there is no, to my knowledge, there is no maximum. So the trua could be as long and as have as many tramutin or kolos as you wanted. But keep in mind, the longer you do your trua,
right,
then the longer you're going to have to do your tekiah.
Right. That can take the wind out of you.
Yeah. By the way, there is an interesting little side point here. It's not often that the Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch have to claim that something in the Shulchan Aruch, something in the Mechaber, is a Ta'a Sofer. But in this area, there is a Ta'a Sofer. In one of the longest or complicated Se'ifim about Tekiah Shofer, the Mechaber is explaining what the different lengths should be of the various kolos, and when he explains when he's trying to explain what I call the hamburger rule, maybe he should have stuck to that name, the hamburger rule. Instead, he ends up describing it in terms of the more classical way, of course, that the Gemara describes it in terms of trumitin, which are sort of like minimal beats, and in a particular case, so the Mechaber ends up saying that you should have, let's say, surrounding a shvarim and trua, he ends up saying that you should have yud beis trumitin. In other words, the tekiah should have 12 beats, so to speak. And if you look at the logic, and if you look at the original sources, that's all wrong. And the Be'er Heitev and the Mishnah Brura, and I guess everyone else, points out ta'a sofer. He did not mean 12. He meant 18, which would be 9 plus 9. Because the minimum size of shvarim, well, let's start with trua. The minimum size of a trua would be 9. So that's 9 beats. And shvarim would be 3 shevers, each shever also being 3 beats. So you would end up there, therefore, with 9 beats, so to speak, for the shvarim, and 9 beats for the trua. So he really meant to say, according to all the Nosei Kelim, he meant to say that the tekiah should be at least 18 beats.
Oh, wow.
But he said yud beis, and then you can see everyone footnotes it and says ta'a sofer, ta'a sofer.
So the shvarim trua is going to be a lot longer of a tekiah, obviously.
So the shvarim trua together needs to be the tekiah needs to be the same length as the shvarim trua.
Right, not just as one half of those.
Right, it's got to be the length of both. And if you did a longer trua, then you have to have a longer tekiah.
So advice for somebody who's just starting out in terms of learning a trua, it's obviously safer to learn more than 9.
That's a very great point. I'm glad you mentioned that. So as a musician, and I'm not just a trumpet player, but I am also a drummer. And as a drummer, you could imagine that I have, you know, beats and rhythm in my head, you know, very, very solid. And the first year that I blew, I can tell you with a certainty that all of my truos were 9 kolos each, 9 trumitin each. Because for me, the number 9 as a musician and as a drummer, it's a very common number. A 9-stroke roll in drums is very common. So I can assure you they were 9. But someone, understandably, afterwards said, you know, it sounded like your truest were too short.
Hmm.
Because look, the average person is probably going to do more than 9 and is probably used to hearing more than 9. I will guarantee you that they were 9. But because that person said it, so now I do 13.
Oh, interesting.
So all of my truas are 13, and my takios are long enough, you know, to cover that.
All right, I want to talk a little bit about the different types of sounds that there are and what people add to the front or to the end of it. Mm-hmm. If you could talk a little bit about that. I don't even know what those are called. I've been calling them hooks all day.
Hooks, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Not sure if that's correct.
It's as good a name as any.
So
yeah, sure. So I think that there's really two aspects to these little extra sounds that are added. So I think some people, well, two aspects. The first aspect I would say is just, I don't want to call it shtus, it's just what you would call an artifact. It's just something that some people do. So there might be some people, especially people who haven't practiced a lot. Oh, we haven't spoken about practicing.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay, that's important. Okay. So if someone hasn't practiced a lot, or if, God forbid, if they're, you know, they're a little short on air, so there may be a tendency for them to tense up more at the end of a kol, especially the end of a tekiah. So some people might, just because they're tensing up at the end of the tekiah, they might go like this. Because they get to the end and they're just trying to squeeze out some air, and so it gives that little glitch at the end, that hook or whatever. So that's just an artifact of the person having a physical issue that's causing him to do that. So I've seen that happens with some people, and I don't believe that there's any, I don't believe it's premeditated, I don't believe there's any reason to do that, and it's just an artifact. On the other hand, there is, when it comes to the shvarim, there are bona fide minhagim regarding the shvarim, which basically I believe are made to make them sound more like a cry. You'll have to pardon me because I've never really even tried to do it, because I always do a straight or pashut shever, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But there are people who do it something like this, if I can even try to do it. Something like that, right? So whereas I go, but others would do like. Now, my understanding is that minhag, which is a totally bona fide minhag, is to make it sound more like a cry, a geshrei. And that's totally fine. Now, then why do I do a pushit? So the argument for doing a pushit sound, a straight sound, is as follows. We see that there is great machlokesin between, I think it's Rashi and others, about how long a shever should be. And what is the big concern when they talk about how long a shever should be? They're worried, well, obviously they want it to be longer than the note, the trumitin in a trua. They obviously want it to be longer than that. So let's say they want it to be at least 2 of those or 3 of those beats that a trua would be made up of, but they don't want it to be too long. Why don't they want the shever to be too long? Because as I mentioned before, because then it could be thought to be a tekiah instead. If it's a tekiah, then it's not a shever. So, given that machlokas exists, and given how careful one should be to make sure that their shever is not too long, then it follows that if the Rishonim was so worried about people thinking that the shever is a tekiah, and we know really a tekiah is supposed to be a kol pashut, a tekiah is supposed to be a straight sound. If the Rishonim were worried about long shvarim being confused as a tekiah, those shvarim must have been straight sounds.
Right.
Because if it's a curly sound with, you know, with a hook at the end or whatever it is, so no one's going to think it's a tekiah because it's a geshrai with this with the hook and going up and going down. So at least one justification for doing a shever as a straight kol is simply because working backward from that machlokes, it would seem like they were dealing with shvarim, where each shever was a straight kol that could be confused with a tekiah if it was too long.
Huh, interesting.
And one other interesting thing about the sounds. I don't remember if it's the Yemenites or some other type of Sephardi. When it comes to a trua, so we do individual sounds like this. But there are Sephardis that do a ululation, a little bit like when you hear the Sephardi women going. So they do that on the shofar. I don't really know how to do that, so I'm not going to try to do it. But there is this other minhag that exists of doing one long kol, but that just goes up and down in intensity or in frequency.
That would be interesting to hear. I guess I have to attend a Yemenite. Maybe like a shachar minyan during Elul.
Well, I'll try to do it now, but you could always cut it out if it doesn't come out good. Okay, I'll try to do what I understand that the this other type of trua is. So I don't know if I got it exactly. Obviously, I've never practiced it, but it's just going up and down, going up and down, but it's one long kol. So that is another minhag.
All right.
Exists.
So speaking of practice, because we brought it up before. I'm a Baal Tefillah. The first year I learned to daven on Yom Nurim, I started like right after Pesach was over. But as the point of the calendar when I started kept moving after Shavuos, after Tisha B'Av. Right now I'm at like Rosh Chodesh Elul. That's when I start really prepping for Rosh Hashanah just to make sure I have everything down correctly. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Baal Tekeah, how early in the calendar do you start practicing, and did that change over the course of time?
I would say I've had a similar experience to your own. The first year, obviously, pretty much the day that I was asked to be the Baal Tekeah, I don't remember what time it was in the year. I'm pretty sure it was probably, actually, Lamaisa, it could have been around Pesach time. And I'm sure that never having been a Baal Tekeah before, I don't remember specifically, but I imagine that I did at that point start practicing, and especially once I was learning the Shulchan Aruch, so just to make sure that I was, getting used to blowing based on what I was learning. Then in subsequent years, I used to start, traditionally the Gabbai of the Shul used to ask me, after Tisha B'Av would be when he would formally ask me to be the Baal Tekeah each year. So I remember at first I used to start practicing then, right after Tisha B'Av. But nowadays, like yourself, I start the beginning of Elul. That's right. When I practice. And an important note about practicing. So I grew up, and when I was a youngster and then a teenager, I davened in two different shtiblach, and they were very chashuv shtiblach. The first shtibl, the Rav had actually learned with the Chafetz Chaim, because this is going back to, I was there in the 60s and early 70s. So the Rav was an older man, and he had learned in Radin. Very chashuv shul. The Baal Tekeah was a very chashuv yid, who was musmach from Rav Moshe. Very chashuv yid, a very busy person, involved in many things. And although I don't know specifically, because I was only, a kid then, I was whatever, 9 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, but he had great difficulty on Rosh Hashanah. And, I'd like to be mezakeh him to say that, his mind was so full of worrying about kavanos that he wasn't, able to get all the kolos out right. But really, I suspect he did not practice enough. Now, why would that be? I will tell you right now, he was a good Baal Tekeah. But even the best Baal Tekeah has to practice. That's the key point here. And in fact, last year, I was asked to give a class on Zoom by Rabbi Rosenberg to a number of people who were being, because of COVID, they were being put into position of having to be Baal Tekeah for the first time, let's say for backyard minyanim or for themselves in their house. And so he had me give a class, and I'll tell you how I started the class. When I shared my screen, the first thing that everyone saw was one of these calendars from the web that count down. So I had it set down to count down to when Rosh Hashanah was. So everyone saw that it was counting down, 34 days, 12 hours, et cetera, and 9 minutes, 8 minutes, and, et cetera. They saw a countdown clock in front of them. And I told them why this countdown clock is up there. Because I said to them, if you're going to be blowing shofar to be yotze the mitzvah, and especially to be yotze other people, and especially if you're davening it, if you're going to be blowing in a shul to be yotze the kahal, then if you haven't started practicing now, you're too late. You need to do it. You need to practice every day. A person could know perfectly how to blow shofar, but if you're not in practice, you're going to have a problem. First of all, you're doing 100 kolos. You're doing it in front of people. That makes you nervous. It's inevitable. You're doing it for the mitzvah, okay, for, you know, for Klal Yisrael. That's going to make you nervous. There are going to be, you know, various types of interruptions, whatever they may be, that may, you know, get your mind off of it. If you're nervous, you have trouble controlling your air, and your column of air is the most important thing. So you have to be in full practice so that you've got 150% of capability going into it so that you can do a good job. And I'm sure it's the same thing with being a shliach tzibur.
It is the exact same thing. I remember the first year I davened Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, the first day, I ran out of gas somewhere around Shofros. Mm-hmm. My voice caught. I couldn't do anything. And that was primarily because at that point, I had never practiced the entire Musaf straight through. I practiced mm-hmm. them in sections mm-hmm. because that's what I did. I didn't even think of this, of having this whole long time to practice it. And I'm guessing for kids who are learning Bar Mitzvah Parsha, it's the same thing. If you're only practicing a section, you might have a problem once you get into like Chamishi, Shishi, Shvi, if you haven't, you're not used to expending that much energy. The next day, I still didn't have it down to where, because I davened Musaf both days, I didn't have it down to where I was able to get as much out of it as I need to in order to maintain the same amount of energy throughout the entire time.
But you probably knew to pace yourself.
I paced myself more. Right. Over the next couple of years, I was able to build up my stamina so that I can go the entire time at full throttle. But the second day that year, I backed down from mm-hmm. what I was going to do
right.
on the second day.
In fact, Izzo, what you mentioned about, like in your case, it was a matter of not having practiced it all at one shot. So for a Baal Takea, it's actually you have the opposite requirement. Let's say you're working yourself up to 100 kolos, and now you've practiced for a few days or maybe a couple of weeks, and you've gotten it that you can do 100 kolos. And really, you should probably practice more than 100 kolos in order to give yourself 150% of capability. But once you've gotten yourself up to being able to do 100 kolos, what you have to do now is really the opposite of what you as a shliach tzibur had to do. You have to practice doing 30 kolos, and then stopping for a while,
right?
And then doing more kolos, and then stopping for a while, and then doing more kolos. And it makes a difference. And in fact, if for people who have the bad habit of pushing the mouthpiece or the shofar hard into their lips, they may discover that their lips swell up. And you don't see that right away. If you blow 100 straight, you won't see that. But blow 30, and if you're pushing the mouthpiece into the lips, which is not really the best thing to do, but if you're doing that, now 15 minutes later or whatever it is, or 20 minutes later, when you blow again, you may find that you can't get a note out because your lips swelled up a little and now everything's off. And I'm sure people who have seen this kind of problem where, wow, he sounded so great before, and now why is he having the trouble getting a note out of the shofar? Usually if that happens, it's because, number one, the lips swelled up, and number two, his practice pattern didn't account for that. So he's never faced that before. It's still possible to blow if your lips are swollen, but you're going to put the mouthpiece on your lips a little differently, and you may not have practiced that before.
I guess it's more analogous to like somebody who exercises, because if you're exercising and you're lifting weights, and you lift weights for like 10 minutes, and then you take a 40-minute break until you lift it again, your muscles kind of just... They revert back and they're not loose anymore. Mm. And now you're very tight in what you're doing. So it's a lot harder. It's a lot easier to continuously lift weights for like a 45-minute period than lifting for 10 minutes and then break for 45 minutes and then another 10 minutes and then break for 45 minutes and then another 10 minutes. Because it just doesn't work with what your muscles are used to. You can't just stop and go like that. I wonder if that's there are muscles in the mouth also. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about dry lips, but maybe it's also, you know, hard on the muscles in the mouth.
The orbicularis oris.
Not a doctor.
Me neither, but a trumpet player.
You would know that. Someone who's looking to learn how to blow shofar, what advice would you give them that they're starting out? And would that be different for musicians versus non-musicians? And even if it's a difference between, let's say, a piano player versus a sax or a trumpet player?
Well, only a trumpet player or a trombone player or a French horn player will be the type of musician that has a leg up when it comes to blowing shofar. other musicians will not technically have any leg up except for one thing. Musicians will understand the necessity and the discipline of practice. They will understand that one has to practice, and also musicians will certainly know that they have to know the score or the chart in advance, which in our case for shofar, of course, means learning the halachos. So, but certainly a trumpet player, a French horn player, any of the buzzing mouthpiece instruments, as opposed to, let's say, sax, which is different. Saxophone does not use the same type of mouthpiece, but any of the true brass instruments like trumpet, certainly they'll have a leg up. But that aside, anyone can learn how to do it. It's really a matter of buzzing the lips. And in fact, when you start to learn, the best thing to do is to first buzz, doing what I guess some people call spitting, which is just to go like this. Just to kind of get the feel of that in their lips, so that when they put the shofar to their lips, they understand they're not going to blow into it, they're going to buzz into it. So that's the first thing, is just to realize that what you're doing is buzzing your lips into the shofar. The second thing is to understand that every shofar has its sweet spot. Every shofar has one or maybe two notes, on a larger shofar maybe three or four notes, that are the optimum note to blow. And let me show you what I mean. I'm going to take my shofar, and on purpose I'm going to hold my lips a little differently than I normally would, and I'm going to come out with a sound that's not as pure as one would like. Well, first I'll start off with a pure sound. This is what you'd want a sound to sound like. Now I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to try to blow a note, maybe like a few notes higher, let's say. Or lower. Now those notes are not as pure. And the truth is, because I'm a trumpet player, I'm just instinctively making them work. But a regular person wouldn't be able to do that. So a regular person has to find what's the right slot for them. It has to do with physics and harmonics. But basically, you have to experiment a little to find what is the right note. And once you for you, on that shofar, and once you find that note, you have to always strive to hit the same note. It should become pretty natural, because all the other notes will sound bad to you, and you'll find that there's a certain way of blowing the shofar that will sound better than others. So you have to, at first you have to experiment, and then from then on, always just blow that one note that is right for that shofar. If and when you happen to switch to another shofar, it's going to be a different note. It's going to be a slightly different feel of the mouthpiece on your lips.
Hmm. By the way, can you play a song on a shofar?
Sure.
Wow, that's amazing. Have you ever done that at a wedding?
Not on shofar. I've played that song
on shofar
too many times on a trumpet, but not on a shofar.
Nobody's ever asked you to play it on a shofar?
No.
That's amazing.
No.
Wow, that was so cool. What's the hardest thing for you to blow? Hardest note? Is it of the normal ones? Not.
Oh, you mean in terms of kolos?
Yeah.
I don't find them hard.
You don't find them hard? Okay.
No.
Starting out, you don't want anyone?
What do you mean?
When you were first starting out, was there one that was more tricky to get down?
Well, I just know from having spoken to other people that a trua is probably, for someone who has not played trumpet, the trua is difficult, because what's happening with the trua is you're constantly interrupting the flow of air and starting a new note rapidly. So that's very difficult. So that's something that people have to know to start off, practice it slow. If when you start learning how to blow a shofar, you have to, trua, you should basically be doing shvarim, okay? You should first get your shvarim down, okay? And then you're essentially doing more shevers, more shvarim, okay? And then gradually making them smaller. So a beginner should probably practice a trua like this. Something like that. And then gradually speed up, because otherwise a novice, if they pick up the shofar for the first time and try to do a trua with the fast speed that we normally expect from it, it might sound like this. I'm going to blow from the other side of my mouth just to degrade it a little. like it won't sound clean because you're moving your tongue fast, you're interrupting the air rapidly. So start off practicing it slow. And then when as long as it's clean, start speeding it up. But if it gets sloppy, then slow down because you don't want to practice mistakes.
Michael, I thank you so much for all of this. Do you have any book recommendations or safer recommendations for people who are either starting to learn or even just for general knowledge on where to look for more information?
So the best safer that I have for overall general knowledge is a safer called Kol Shofar. It's written in Hebrew. It's written by Rabbi Amram Buskila. And it's a very comprehensive sefer. It covers halacha, and it also does it in terms of different minhagim for different communities, you know, different countries and what their minhagim are. And it also speaks, it has a lot of sections on the different ta'amim, the different kavanas to have in mind. It speaks about all the different aspects where we're trying to be ma'arev the satan, for example. You know, a lot of the things we do when it comes to Kiyah Shofar, there are a lot of menhagim and practices that have to do with so-called confusing the satan. He goes into that a lot. He goes into all kinds of midrashim about the shofar and its effects. And also, interestingly, in his introduction, his first chapter, it's entitled HaShofar, B'Torah, B'Neviim, U'V'Ksuvim, U'V'Toldos Am Yisrael. And it's a 60-page chapter that goes through all references of the use of the shofar in Chumash, obviously, and Neviim, and historically. And he gets into how the shofar is, you know, plays a part historically for the Jewish nation, let's say in terms of the time of war, in times of a way of crying out, let's say when there's a tinus for a famine, that the shofaros were used, and even today might be still applicable to do that. In the past, he talks about how it was used at a levaya for dead people, and a whole bunch of other circumstances that he lists here. So it's a great, just kind of a great introduction almost to like the philosophy of the shofar, and then he covers the halacha. And what I would say is people really should learn the Mishnah Brura, but nevertheless, his halacha chapter is very comprehensive and gives the most common practices. Of course, anyone who's going to be blowing in for a shul should sit down with the Rav and discuss the particular menhagim of the shul and the particular piskei halacha that particular Mora d'Asra feels is applicable for that particular kahal.
Good piece of advice. Sound advice, if I could use a pun. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you think is important that people should know?
Well, here's some good sound advice. I'll tell you some sound advice that just results from my own experience, my first year blowing. So I learned how to blow the shofar. I practiced very diligently. I knew for a surety that I could blow 200 or 300 kolos in one day. So I really wasn't worried about that going into my first actual time blowing some 26 years ago or whenever it was. 27 years, I think. So yet, even with all that practice, I remember that my first year, I hurt my lip so much so that on the second day, it was hard to blow because it was almost like a little puffiness or a scab on my lip the second day. And I realized afterwards why that probably was. First of all, I must have been nervous. And maybe because I was nervous, maybe I overblew or, you know, blew too hard or pushed it in too hard. But also, I do remember that the sound was so different than blowing in my house. And I think, I really don't know, you know, how the human body or brain reacts to these sort of things in a sort of a feedback sort of way. But I think whatever was coming back at me made me change or vary the amount of air or the amount of pressure or whatever that I was putting through the shofar. And it ended up being a big irritation for my lips, even though I was in practice. So I suspect that for a new Baal Tokea who's never blown before, it may make a lot of sense sometime before Rosh Hashanah, it may make sense to go into the shul you're going to be blowing in and to practice blowing in there, in the shul, just so you have that feel of what it, you know, what it sounds like and how your body, if at all, reacts to that.
Right. Not to, again, compare it to davening as a Baal Tefillah, but the first time, because I used to daven before I was married also, but the first time I davened for the Amud with my talis over my head, like the sound was different because the talis is blocking your ears. Mm-hmm. And I remember like during davening, tucking my talis behind, like still over my head, but tucking it behind my ears just so I could hear what I was saying. Over the years, I was able to readjust to figure out what it was, but it does throw you off if the sound coming back to you is not what you expected.
Right. Yep, it's the same thing, definitely. Yeah.
All right, Michael, this was so much fun. Thank you so much. This was really cool. And I appreciate you taking the time out for this. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Tiskel and Mitzvos keep doing these wonderful podcasts about important topics.
All right, thank you. My thanks to Michael Cohen for joining us this week. As ever, when we discuss halacha on the show, please do not paskin anything based on what you have heard on a podcast. If you have a shaila about shofar, as always, it is best to consult with your rabbinic authority. Until next time, kol tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.